And this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. We're streamed on the Internet at khen.org, and if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien. And and my guest tonight is John Lear. And it takes me a moment to get together after being discombobulated. And John Lear was a pilot and well-known ufologist, and he's the son of an aviation pioneer, inventor, and founder of the Learjet Corporation, Bill Lear. John is currently the owner and operator of Cutthroat Mining Corporation, the only permitted gold mine in Clark County, Nevada, and in 1999 he received the State of Nevada Excellence in Mining Reclamation Award for site restoration of the Treasure Hot Gold Butte Mine. John resides in Las Vegas, Nevada, with his wife, Marilee Lear, who's a casting director in Las Vegas. And John is highly regarded in the aviation circles, is now retired from flying, and he amassed over 19,000 hours of flight time, has flown over 100 different types of airplanes in 60 different countries around the world. He flew both commercially and in missions worldwide for the CIA. John Lear holds the most FAA airman certificates ever earned by any single airman and has held numerous world records. And in 1966, he was a co-pilot of the Learjet Model 24 that completed the first round-the-world flight by a business jet, beginning and ending in Wichita, Kansas. Together with two Lear Factory pilots, Hank Beard and Rick King, set 17 world records between May 23rd and 26th, including speed around the world. So, John, nice to have you back.
Thank you.
And thanks for your patience. Just when you're doing it by yourself and then you miss one little button, it can throw you way off when you're trying to get it all together again. So, John, every time I get to go to your website, it's just so fascinating to see all the different avenues of interest that you have. And is there anything more that you'd like to explain about yourself after the introduction I gave? Because it may not have been the one that you like to use the most. I don't know. Sometimes there's different things out there that get printed up that may add or not add enough information.
Well, you know, first of all, that's not my website. If you're talking about the livingmoon.com, it belongs to Ron Schmidt and Pegasus. What I do is mm-hmm. I contribute a lot of the articles and photos to it.
Well, and Katie, are you there?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you tonight, John, about something you called the Yellow Book. You said it is a government record of all the alien crash retrievals.
Yeah, the Yellow Book is a book that the government keeps, and it has all the information from the original contact that they were aware of with aliens up until the present.
And does this go back like hundreds of years or just within the last 100 years?
No, probably since Roswell. I haven't seen the book myself, but I've been told about it. And some of the UFOs we recovered were in the 30s and early 40s. But all the public knows about was the most public one, was 1947, and that was the Roswell incident.
But this Yellow Book is new to me. Where did you find this one, Katie?
Well, I've been watching John. He's one of the most fascinating people I've ever read about. The gravity you talked about in regard to two types of gravity, gravity B being the type that holds up the Earth, and you said that gravity A is on an atomic scale.
Right. That's what's presently known as the strong nuclear force, and that's what holds atomic particles together. Gravity B is the gravity that holds us onto the Earth, and the Earth in the Moon in orbit around the Earth, and the Earth in orbit around the Sun.
And I understand that you need that they use a gravity phone. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that was a story that I heard from Bob Lazar, that when he was working up at S4, that he was saying that we sent a message to the apparently the owners of the Greys, who live thousands of light years from here, that if they didn't help us get rid of the Greys, that nobody was going to have Earth. In other words, that we were going to blow up Earth.
Wait a minute, before we get too far into this, because you got a chance to talk to John a little bit beforehand, so I think you're kind of a little bit ahead of our audience right here.
Yeah, a little.
And so can we get back to, who's Bob Lazar?
Bob Lazar was a scientist that went to work for the U.S. Navy up at a very secret base called S4, just to the southwest of Area 51, Groom Lake. And he worked there for about 6 months. And his job was to see if to help back engineer six of the UFOs that we had recovered from aliens. They had a propulsion system that we were trying to duplicate, but the fact is it was hundreds of thousands of years of technology ahead of us, and there was no way we could duplicate it.
And so where does, I guess I'm trying to figure it. Katie, when you guys were first talking earlier, how did, as far as the aliens, how do you know Bob Lazar? I mean, how did you two get acquainted and get to be familiar with each other?
I met Bob Lazar in the summer of 1988. I had given a lecture at the Spring Valley Library here in Las Vegas on UFOs, and a guy called me up and asked if he could have a copy of all my tapes and information. And he said he was a appraiser, and I needed an appraisal for my house, so I traded all these copies of tapes and information for the appraisal of the house. And when he came over to do the appraisal, he brought a friend of his to hold the tape measure, and that friend was Bob Lazar. And that's how I met Bob, and this was the summer of 1988. And the appraiser's name was Gene Huff, and Gene and I were talking about UFOs and the Billy Meyer case and all different kinds of things, and Bob was rolling his eyes and completely disinterested, and we asked him why. He said, I had a top secret clearance. I worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories. If there had been anything like this, if there had been anything about UFOs, I would know about it. And he said, it's just not true. So anyway, during the fall of 1988 and approaching winter, we had given Bob enough information that he was able to check out with friends of his that still worked at Los Alamos. And he found out that, in fact, that stuff was true. And he wanted to find out for himself whether or not, really what was going on. So Bob knew Dr. Teller. Dr. Teller, of course, was the father of the H-bomb. And he called Dr. Teller, who worked at Lawrence Livermore Labs out in California, and said that he would like to re-enter the scientific community, and could he help him? And Dr. Teller said, well, sure, Bob, do you want to work out here at Livermore with me, or do you want to work out in Nevada? And Bob said, I want to work up at Area 51. And Dr. Teller said, let me see what I can do. So over the next two or three weeks, Bob was called in to EG&G, which was then the main contractor at the Nevada test site. for three interviews. They were technical interviews, and apparently he passed with flying colors because on December 6th of 1988, he came over to my house and sat down, and he said, I saw a disc today. And I said, you saw a disc? What do you mean you saw a disc? And he said, I saw a flying saucer. And I said, theirs or ours? And he said, theirs. And I said, you mean you went to Area 51? He said, well, it was a place called S4. And he began to tell me all about what he had seen. And I said, well, why in the world are you telling me all this? Because you got to know that they're following you, and they know exactly where you've come tonight. And he said, well, actually, he says, I'm doing this because you have taken so much static over this for the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you that everything you said is true.
Okay, so Katie, do you want to, you were bringing up Bob and asking some of these questions. You want to kind of, is there some way to tie in what you, where you were going with some of those questions on Bob?
Oh, sure, sure. John, in regard to the conspirators you talked about there's one version where they may travel into the future to observe things. So do they have access to time travel, and is the time travel ours or theirs?
Now, are you saying can the aliens go forward and backward in time?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Time is unique to Earth and several other planets, but it's just a it's an illusion just for Earth and us. Other than that, there is no such thing as time, but the aliens can, in fact, go back and forwards in time. Mm-hmm. In other words, when they do their abductions, they can take somebody for an hour and bring him back and make it seem like no time had passed at all.
When Billy Meyer speaks of things like that, are you a I'm not quite sure I... When I look at some of the information on him, I'm still just learning a little bit about him. Now, you're familiar with Billy Meyer?
Very familiar, yeah.
Okay. There was a couple of things that was... What he accomplished in his lifetime was just so phenomenal to... Besides all the information that he got from his... whoever he was speaking to... That I'm not quite sure. You want to explain a little bit more about him then? I don't even know how to describe it.
Billy Myers was a Swiss farmer that was contacted by allegedly Pleiadians that landed a craft on his property. He was able to take pictures, able to take photographs, able to take moving pictures. And they gave him a lot of information. And I think this was basically in the late 70s. And he has disseminated a lot of this information. He is highly criticized as being a fraud, but in fact, the Billy Myers story was true.
Uh-huh.
But it has been so contaminated over the past 30 or 40 years that that it's hard to tell what the real story was and what it wasn't.
And I imagine you've taken a lot of flack on you know, being able to speak about all these different subjects. How do you?
Yeah,
do
it comes with the territory.
So, Katie, go ahead with what you were getting into on the time travel. Katie?
Do we have time travel? Are you aware that humans actually time travel, or is this just something that the alien groups are able to do? Or is it just the grays?
Now, say that again.
In regard to the time travel, is it just the grays that actually time travel, or do other alien groups also time travel?
There's millions and millions of other alien species, and they can all time travel.
So this is just something that's tied to those of us that is on in this earth, on the earth, then, is what you're saying.
time itself is something that is unique to Earth and several other planets. But outside of this, time doesn't exist.
In coming from the background, I mean, because you, it was really quite interesting just reading that your father had some experience with working with the space program. Am I correct?
Yes, in 1952, his company, Lear Incorporated, was involved in the original attempt to make anti-gravity machines. And I think that the U.S. Had operational anti-gravity by 1956. And Lear Incorporated was a main contractor in that.
No, no, Bob, this is Shannon. You've got such an enormous background in all of this, and I know that you know you have gone through a lot of interviews over the years, explained a lot of these things over and over, and also been threatened to stop doing that. And you did take a break for a while, and came back, and great interview on Art Bell. That also you delved into a little of the 911 stuff, and that's one of the things that we also have had on this radio program. A lot of interest in what the government is doing. Not a whole lot of alien involvement. What I would wonder is, with your background, you can kind of gauge a little more about what the government or those who've hijacked the government are thinking about the aliens and what their response is to, and what their staging of 9/11 and their staging of all kinds of other activities and executive orders, how these things might fit together with, you know, because you look at a lot of these things, and it's like, well, are they crazy? Do they just, they not care about the planet? You know, they're willing to blow up so much. I mean, what is, how does the alien component of their theory possibly help to explain some of these other things that we see, including the UN and the if you can include those in some integratory way without, you know, stretching too far, you know what I mean? I mean, there's got
to
be a lot.
I'm trying to follow. What is the question?
Well, there's got to be a lot that you know about how the military slash government slash sort of, you know, rogue group that use the government to do nefarious things that we sometimes talking about all over the place.
I think what he's asking about is, how do you see the role of the military in what's going on with current events, such as 9/11, or with the current agenda?
Or how do they see the alien thing sort of driving them to do some of these other things? I mean, do you have like a sort of like a little psychoanalysis in a way of what happens to a government and a military when they feel like there's an alien presence, and maybe that why that drives them to do certain things?
Well, the aliens give us neat toys. Now, not the regular public, but they give the military and black ops neat toys to play with to keep them busy. And our technical base is about 50 years ahead of where people think it is. And of course, 9/11, there were no 19 hijackers. It was not a Muslim hijacker type of deal. As a matter of fact, there were no airplanes that crashed on 9/11. It was all video fakery. And the purpose of that, of the whole 9/11 scenario, was fivefold. Number one, they wanted to create an enemy that we could all rally against and go after. And that was because we have a military machine, and we had run out of enemies such as Grenada, Panama, and little countries, and we had to come up with a large enemy that that would last forever. So we decided to pick on Arab Muslims. So that's what 9/11 was all about. But there were no Arab hijackers. There were no plane crashes. But anyway, the primary purpose of that was, number one, we wanted to invade Afghanistan, and we needed to make the enemy, the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda and the Arab Muslims in Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden, the bad guys, and we had to go after him. But essentially what we needed was to go into the Hindu Kush, which is in the northeast part of Afghanistan in a primary growing zone for opium poppies. And one of the primary sources of income from black ops is from drug running. And in 2001, the production of the opium poppy from Afghanistan was something like 13%, according to the New York Times. In August of 2007, the New York Times published an article in which said that the opium production in Afghanistan was now 94% of the world production. And the reason it was is because we went in, improved the cultivation, improved the sowing of the seeds, the harvesting, the cultivation, the distribution and sale of those drugs. A lot of it goes into Tajikistan to the north, and a lot of it goes out to the south. But that was the primary objective, was to take over the Hindu Kush and start growing poppies from which we could get money to create more money to finance these black operations. The second objective was to go into Iran and to get their oil, and to also create a base to attack Iran. The reason we wanted to attack Iran is because the main oil fields in the Caspian Sea, the pipeline from there runs through Iran, eastern Iran, and down to the Persian Gulf, and we don't want to share that profit or that oil with Iran. So eventually we're going to have to attack Iran to be sure that they don't get a part of that.
You know, you're real familiar with that part of the world, and you've done a lot of flying in those areas over the years, correct?
Yeah, I lived in Egypt for a couple of years and flew different missions. One of the missions was in 1978 when the Camp David Accords were signed. Both Egypt and Israel, co-signees of the Camp David Accords, agreed to fly into each other's, make passenger flights into each other's country 4 times a week. Well, of course, Al, which is the Israeli airline, didn't mind flying into Egypt, but you could not find a Egyptian that would fly into Israel. So they had to create a bogus company, which was called Air Sinai, of which I was chief pilot, and we flew the 4 flights a week into Israel, into Tel Aviv, pretending that we were Egyptians. And that went on for several years. There were a number of other programs that we did.
Was that easy for you to pass yourself off as an Egyptian?
Yeah, how do you act like an Egyptian?
Well, of course, you know, nobody really believed that. It's just a political deal. It's
I see. It was in title only?
Yeah.
And the other thing is okay, with your pilot experience, and you're saying that there was no planes in the towers. Do you want to explain a little bit more about why you feel this way?
Yeah, first of all, both NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and several others have said that the airplane that attacked the South Tower was doing 560 miles an hour. Boeing 767. Of course, this is impossible. And I wrote an affidavit to the New York District Court in support of the motion to oppose the motion to dismiss the suit that Morgan Reynolds filed. It was a quidam complaint. A quidam complaint is a suit against was against 23 companies that filed that gave NIST false information and charged them for it. And this is against the law, and when you file a suit like that, it's called a quidam complaint. Anyway, the 23 different companies were named, and this suit was making its way through the New York District Court. And in December, I got a call from Morgan and his attorney, Jerry Liebhardt, and they had heard me on the radio explaining why it was impossible for a Boeing 67 to fly at that speed. And they asked me if I would write an affidavit explaining that to the court, which I did. And basically, there's five reasons why an airplane cannot fly that fast. First of all, on the Boeing 767, the maximum speed is 360 knots, which is about 420 miles an hour. And that speed is based on how fast it can fly and how fast it can perform under the certification requirements of CFR 14 Part 25. Airplanes have to go through lengthy and exact flight maneuvers to prove that they can fly safely at 360 knots. And one of those maneuvers is they have to go through what they call an upset, which is flying at the speed that they want to cruise at, 360 knots, point the nose down 7.5 degrees for 20 seconds, and then be able to recover without exceeding 420 knots. This means that what they want to prove is the airplane cannot possibly exceed 420 knots. The reason it can't exceed 420 knots, there's three reasons. Number one is parasite drag, which increases after 360 knots because of the shape of the airfoil. It just can't physically go any faster. The other is parasite power, which means to double the airspeed, you need to cube the power. So the power of a Boeing 767 is 63,000 pounds of thrust. So basically, what you're saying here is 63,000 times 63,000 times 63,000, which is a cube, and then you take the difference between the airspeed that it can actually achieve, which is about 400 knots, and the speed that it was allegedly going, which is 560 knots, and so that's about 23%. That's 23%. Of 63,000 times 63,000 times 63,000. It's impossible. There's no possible way that an airplane could go that fast. Now, in addition to that, the airplane uses, that particular airplane used Pratt & Whitney engines, which are rated at that thrust, and they can achieve Mach 8.6 as a cruise speed at 35,000, 36,000 feet. Well, when they come down to sea level, the air is three times as dense, so there's no possible way to cram air that's three times as dense into these engines as they try to increase their speed. It's impossible. So anyway, I told this to the court. I outlined this court and used the book Aerodynamics for Naval Aviators and the graphs in there to explain why it was impossible. Now, in addition to this, there was four airplanes that allegedly crashed, one in the North Tower, one in the South Tower, one at Shanksville, and one at the Pentagon. There were no airplanes that crashed, starting with the ones in the World Trade Center. Each airplane is an assembly of about 2 million parts. Each one of those parts has to be approved by parts manufacturer authority. Each part, when it's made, contains a part number which is engraved or painted or put somehow on each part. So, and of course, none of those parts were found or identified at any of the four crash sites. In addition to that, the Boeing 757 has about 60 miles of wire, and the Boeing 767 has about 90 miles of wire, and each 6 inches of each part or each foot of each of those miles and miles and miles of wire are identified, and they're identified by where they're going, where they come, and the electrical rating. And there was not one single part of any of that wire found at any of the crashes. Now, I've been flying for 40 years. I've investigated accidents. I've worked on airplanes. I know how they're built. In Shanksville, there was absolutely no possibility of an airplane crashing there. There was no parts. There was no parts around there. All that we saw was one small turbine that was in the bucket of a backhoe that was there. but there was no engines, no parts of airplanes, nothing around there. So no plane crashed there. As far as the Pentagon, April Gallup, who was a military intelligence specialist, was sitting 40 feet away from the hole where an alleged airplane came through. And she was sitting at her desk with her six-month-old son when the explosion came. And she said it was a big explosion, but not that big. And part of the ceiling came down, and she reached down, got her son, which was in his little kind of car seat at her desk, put him over his shoulder, and crawled through that hole, which we're told an airplane went through. She says she saw no airplane, she saw no missile, she smelled no fuel, and saw nothing come through there. So there was no airplane, no nothing that happened at the Pentagon.
Do you think that something like maybe the Hutchinson effect or HARP could have created?
No, not HARP, but the Hutchinson effect may have come into effect because during the 9/11 Hurricane Aaron sat 100 miles off the coast of New York, and the counterclockwise circulation had something to do with either directing the smoke coming out of the World Trade Center or something. I don't know exactly what it was, but we have the ability through HARP to form and direct hurricanes. For instance, Hurricane Katrina, we formed and directed to go straight into New Orleans. Why we did that, I don't know. But in fact, we have the capability to do that.
I find that interesting that they would think of something about the smoke and having something like that hurricane, which a lot, you know, it's hard finding the evidence on this hurricane.
Well, the World Trade Center was destroyed by a weapon called that used molecular disassociation. In other words, it actually disassociated the component parts, the molecular structure of steel and concrete. That's why there was nothing left of the World Trade Center. Now they're both 110 feet or 110 stories tall. And if you talk to any demolition expert and ask them how much residue should remain after a controlled demolition of a building, they will tell you it's about 13 to 14%, which means that in the case of the World Trade Center, there should have been 13 or 14 stories of residue. And in fact, there was less than one story. There was nothing left. All there was dust. And most of the dust was 80 microns in diameter, which is extremely small. That's what all the dust that you saw in those photographs, people running down the street in these huge clouds of dust, that was the molecular disintegration of the World Trade Center.
So, John, can you corroborate the Artie Wheeler take on the 9/11 events?
The what?
Do you know Artie Wheeler?
I'm not familiar. Refresh my memory.
Okay, well, he's talked about a scalar weapon and scalar imagery used in the B-2 used to create the illusion of planes hitting the tower when they were Tomahawk missiles. He used to build...
They were no missiles, but me and several other people have talked about the technology of holograms, and it's very difficult for people to understand this because they don't understand that technology of black ops is about 50 years ahead. Now, when you talk about holograms, and possibly some of those airplanes were holograms, they say, well, it can't be holograms because you have to have something to project it against, and that's not true. 20 years ago, we had the ability to project holograms of an object with sound, with heat, with movement, and with light into thin air. And it's people that is something that people have a hard time grasping because they don't understand how far ahead technology is. And I try and explain to them. In 2001, a friend of mine attended a very small and very exclusive meeting for television executives called the Future of Television. And they were escorted into this very small kind of a movie theater, you know, the kind that they show various premieres of movies. And it seated about 30 people. There was a podium, and the very, very high-powered executives were there, including a friend of mine. And they were invited to attend, and it was well-lit. There was lots of light there. And what happened was a gentleman came from backstage up to the podium. They described him as a elderly Eastern European gentleman, white hair, spoke with an accent, had glasses, and started to talk about the history of television. And he started with the development of the cathode ray tube, and how that went into TV, and how they increased from the recordings from kinescopes up to what they have now. And my friend said, frankly, it was a pretty boring presentation, but as he gave the presentation, this guy stepped off the podium, walked up the aisle, cleaning his glasses, walked back down the aisle, climbed up onto the stage behind the podium, and when he was through, he said, "Thank you very much," and then just disappeared. And what it was a demonstration of present-day holograms. He was a hologram. And what they were trying to say is the next generation of TVs won't have any screen at all. All you'll have is a control box where you can put the image of the television program anywhere you want in the room or any size. You can put it on the table. If your room is empty, it can take up the whole room, whatever you want. And if the television industry had that in 2001, you can be sure the military had that 20 years prior.
We've probably seen a lot of that in various demonstrations in movies and things of that sort, where they kind of make a person appear in one place and they're in another spot. Is that what you're kind of describing to us?
Doing it sounds like the holodeck almost on the Star Trek.
Artie Wheeler calls it the same thing you see at the 4th of July celebrations and at like the Pink Floyd rock shows and whatever in the sky, holographic imagery. It's portrayed against no particular background.
Yeah, it's just hard for people to understand that you can project an image into thin air. They think that you need a background or a sheet or a mirror or something like that, and you don't.
Well, is it true about
projected into thin air?
The B-2 or the B-1 bomber, as he said, being able to cast an image of itself ahead and then to either side, so that it looks like there's three
both
in the wrong
place? Both the F-117 and the B-1 have holographic projectors.
And is that different than scalar imagery, then?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Is that different than scalar, or is that could be fairly called an application of scalar? Do you know what that is?
No.
Because a lot of time what we're, you know, I want to ask you, you know, what do you think of George Green's take on Billy Meyer? And I want to ask the questions that help to compare, because we hear from you, we hear from other people around, similar takes, but slightly different. And so that's why I'm wanting on this one point, you know, we hear from Artie Wheeler, who supposedly helped build Boeings and Tomahawks, that there was a weapon in it, and he knows the woman's office in there in one of the buildings that was used to project scalar imagery, as he called it, and also was a component in the scalar weaponry that, as you say and he says, vaporized the concrete there before our eyes.
Well, it sounds like both of them subscribe to the, you know, Judy Woods theory then. Is that correct, John?
Say that again?
You both, would you subscribe to what Dr. Judy Wood believes in, that, you know, that something dustified the towers?
Yeah, Judy Woods is exactly right, and her theory is molecular disassociation, and that's what I believe. And what they fired it from was an orbiting weapon satellite, and those orbiting weapon satellites have been in construction since the early 70s. Many people, the Apollo program never went to the moon. It was a fake. It was all video fakery. But what they did use is the money for that program to start using putting up orbiting weapon satellites. We have about between 8 and 12 up there with all kinds of fancy type weapons that the public knows nothing about. And what kind of led me to that was last September when Discovery launched, or whichever shuttle it was, I noticed something odd. Every time we launched a shuttle, it took 3 days to catch up with the International Space Station. Now, this seemed odd for me because the explanation was, well, the space station is in a inclination of 50.6 degrees, and when we launch, it always seems that we're, you know, a revolution behind. So we have to spend 3 days catching up with the International Space Station. Now, that's been going on for 20 years, and the excuse is kind of getting tired and old, and so I wondered if there wasn't something else going on. So what we did is we started looking for other information of what could be going on, and what we found out is when the space shuttle launches, what it's doing is it has cargo, food, fruit, supplies, and personnel that go to these different orbiting weapons platforms. Now, on each orbiting weapon platforms, there's probably 20 or 30 people up there, and they got to be fed, they got to have cargo, they got to change personnel, and that's what the shuttle was doing during those 3 days, stopping at each one of those, unloading cargo, delivering mail, that kind of stuff. And then when it got to the International Space Station, if ever you've seen any of the pictures when they open the cargo bay, you see that it's only half full. So what they've done is all the rest of the cargo has gone to these orbiting weapons platforms. Now, the other thing we found out is that every time a shuttle docks at the International Space Station, 2 days prior, two Russian Progress rockets have themselves docked at the International Space Station. And so what we figured out was they were doing is the Progress rockets also brought food supplies and cargo. That food supplies and cargo was transferred to the space shuttle, and when it undocked and said goodbye and everything, normally a shuttle from the International Space Station to the Space Kennedy Center should take 54 minutes for a deorbit in landing, but it was always taking 2 days. Why does it take 2 days? Well, on the web in the arguments, the guys that represented NASA were saying, well, they have lots of rest, they got to have 2 8-hour rest periods, and they've got all kinds of checklists to do, which of course was, you know, total baloney. What the space shuttle was doing was taking all that cargo that was unloaded from the Russian Progress rockets and taken back down to the orbiting weapons satellites that they weren't able to service coming up, and service them on their way down.
Now, when you're saying we, who are you talking about? Just a group, a community that speaks on, that has a forum on the net, or do you have a...
The guys that contribute to thelivingmoon.com, there's Ron Schmidt, myself, and the other names you can find out of the people who contribute to thelivingmoon.com and the information we have in there.
Okay, let me go ahead and do a station ID, and this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio. And this is Truth Quest with Melody, and I have support for KHEN and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Incorporated's Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And our guest this evening is John Lear, and my co-host this evening is Shannon Hemingway and Katie O'Brien. And we're talking about a lot of different things, actually, anywhere from 9/11 to time travel to UFOs and that sort of thing. So go ahead and... Shannon or Katie?
It's not your usual mountain talk, in a way. And so, here's one question for you, John. We are in an area where, you know, some people do say they see interesting things in the sky, but there is not a lot of discussion up here. And it's curious to me, the people who you talk about as we and who are contributing to your website and that you've talked to through all the years, how many hundreds or more, maybe, of people with, you know, advanced degrees and who can be considered reasonably sane, without a doubt, to you, how many are talking quite openly about cities on the moon, agreeing with this analysis of 911 about the possibility of space weapons platforms and that sort of a thing?
Okay, now what's the question?
Is it as rare as it seems, here in the mountains or in a rural area? Or can you give us some idea of, like, maybe how many hundreds of people or thousands of people you see each day that are participating with this discussion with, you know, a full serious take on it?
I don't know. The 9/11 movement is gaining steam here because the evidence that there were no airplanes and that it was an inside job is just overwhelming. It's just that people don't think about it. I have friends that I flew with, that I work with, who are extremely intelligent, that I talk about 9/11 to, and they just give me a blank look, you know, like, what are you talking about? I mean, they never thought about it. I said, you know, I try to tell them, do you think 19 hijackers really hijacked 4 sophisticated airplanes? And they say, well, you know, I really never had a chance to think about it. And I say, well, just for instance, how would a hijacker take over a cockpit? In other words, he had to kill both pilots, right? I mean, we had to fly the airplane. So how would he do it? And people never give us any thought. But when I finally pin them down, they say, well, they had box knives, so they probably had to kill him. Well, I said, well, how would they kill him? And they say, well, maybe they slit their throats. And I said, well, if they slit their throats, they would have to get the carotid artery. And what that would do, would that spill blood all over the wheel, all over the instruments, all over the cockpit. Now, and he'd have to do both pilots, otherwise the pilot would be attacking the hijacker. Okay, so now the next thing, after the hijacker allegedly kills the pilot, how does he get him out of the seat? Well, first of all, the seat is mechanically or electrically moved forward, so he'll have to move it backwards. So he has to figure out, number one, how to do it electrically or how to do it mechanically. Then he has to undo the pilot's seat belt. Then he has to pull the pilot out of that seat and into the companionway. And, of course, there's no room for a dead body in the companionway back there, so he has to move him into the galley. And now he has to sit in the seat himself. He probably doesn't have a handkerchief, and there's not many Kleenex boxes in the cockpit, so how is he going to clean up all that mess so that he can fly the airplane? Now, the Boeing 67 has some fairly sophisticated instruments there, and in the case of Flight 175, he was 90 miles or so away. How is he going to find New York? He can't see it from 90 miles, so he's going to generally have to get headed south and pick his way from there. It's just an impossible situation of a hijacking scenario. It can't happen. In the case of Flight 77, when the NTSB or the FBIA, whoever it was, released the flight data, the digital flight data recorder tape, I happen to be an expert in that, and there's 156 channels, and each channel is sampled 8 times a second. And each channel of the digital flight recorder records everything that goes on that airplane. It records the wheel movement, the flaps, the engine speed. I mean, it's just 156 channels. So what I did is the airplane that allegedly took off from Dulles, and what I did is looked at each second of the entire flight to see if I could see, number one, where the flight was taken over. And, of course, the captain of that was Chick Burlingame, and the hijacker was Hani Honjur. So I looked, and there was no, you know, bumping of the controls, no obvious no obvious recording of any incident or part of that flight where the airplane was taken over. But what was interesting is after the airplane got turned around and as it started its descent, something interesting happened with the altimeters. Above 18,000 feet in the United States, all altimeters are set to 2992 inches of mercury. And the reason for that is because they want all airplanes flying at an altitude with regard to all other airplanes. So by setting your altimeter above 18,000 feet to a standard pressure, everybody that's flying at 30,000 or 31,000 feet or whatever, they're all at the exact same altitude. Under 18,000 feet, because of all the pressure changes back and forth in the United States, they change to local pressure. So when an air traffic controller tells you to descend to 10,000 feet, he'll always say something like, American Airlines 77, descend and maintain 10,000 feet, local altimeter is 3021. So as you're descending through 18,000 feet, it's standard for any pilot to change his altimeter, and the co-pilot changes his first, and then the captain changes his, and then they go set and cross-check. They each check each other so that below 18,000 feet, all airplanes in that area are flying with reference to the same pressure altitude. What's interesting in American Airlines Flight 77 is exactly at 18,000 feet. Now remember, Hani Onjur is the only one in the cockpit. The co-pilot's altimeter gets set to 3021. Well, what's interesting about that is the 3021 was the current altimeter setting at Reagan International, which is right next to Pentagon. Well, how would they know? How would Hani Onjur know? He was 150 miles away. There's no way he wasn't talking to air traffic control. It's too far away to pick up the ATIS, which is the automatic transcribed weather broadcast. How would he know how to set it to? But so what's even more interesting than that is the 30 seconds later, the pilot's altimeter is set to 3021. Now, my question is, if Hani Onjur is flying the airplane, what in the world is he going to set the co-pilot's altimeter for? And the other thing is, what in the world is he going to set his altimeter for? Those altimeters are set for that perform a ILS approach or to keep your separation from another airplane. He's going to crash the airplane. What does he care what the altimeter is set at? Not to mention the fact that Hani Onjur never flew above 10,000 feet in his life. How would he know that the altimeters were set to 18,000 feet? And the point of this story is, Hani Onjur wasn't flying that airplane. Two professional pilots were flying it, and they were part of the cover up. That particular airplane, Flight 77, overflew the Pentagon and flew down to about 400 feet, and then flew right by the Pentagon, and then they set off explosives in the part where you saw the black smoke and stuff to make it think like an airplane crashed there. But no airplane crashed at the Pentagon.
So you don't think it could have been? I guess what I'm trying to say is remote controlled. Flown that way?
No. Okay. And let me say, it could be, but it wasn't, because even if it was remote control, they're certainly not going to take the trouble to set the altimeters at 18,000 feet.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, it's. I've heard that one a lot, that story a lot, and that's why I'm curious, you know, and I'd like to hear it from, you know, someone that's flown a lot as to why you didn't think. You know.
And if the plane did not hit the Pentagon, what hit the Pentagon?
I'm sorry, what?
If a plane did not hit the Pentagon, what hit the Pentagon?
Nothing hit the Pentagon. It was an
Nothing.
Explosion that was set off at that area that you saw the explosion at. As I told you before, April Gallup, who was Army intelligence civilian personnel, was sitting 40 feet, her desk was 40 feet away from that where that explosion went off. And she said, yeah, there was a big explosion. Yeah, there was a lot of dust and the debris flying around, she grabbed her son, who was below her desk, and she crawled out that hall, that hole, and walked over to the grass where she was treated for triage.
Well, you know,
She says, you know, she's made the statement, there was no airplane, there was no missile, there was no A-3, there was no aircraft of any kind, nor did she smell any jet fuel, any regular fuel, any diesel fuel. She said no airplane came through, nothing came through there.
Now, then the pictures that we saw where it looked like something came by, I mean, it didn't look like a plane to me, but something kind of went by quickly in that very brief photo footage. So you don't think that that was probably anything there then?
No, that was faked by the Pentagon. First of all, it has the wrong date on there and the wrong time. And,
okay.
You know, there's nothing that I can see there that resembled a Boeing 757 or anything else that that crashed.
Well, they sure have enough stories to confuse you.
Well, once they confiscate every other video from all the other angles and options and then give us a little piece back, we've probably given them a little too much credit to even look at it for any real accuracy.
It's all over now. There was 83 cameras. Why don't you show us some of the good stuff?
Right, right. And that to me right there says everything. I mean, if they really wanted us to know what was going on or whatever, we would have known a long time ago.
There was a guy who broke into the computer there at the Pentagon, a hacker from England who was, I believe, was extradited, charged. I don't know whatever happened with that, but the records that he found were for terrestrial officers' paychecks and pay records for non-terrestrial officers. Presumably those would be the space platform, weapons platform people. Do you have any familiarity with that story?
Yeah, very familiar. I'm getting old and I lost my... Oh, McKinnon. Gary McKinnon.
Yes.
That is plodding along here, and he's going to be probably extradited to the United States, and they're probably going to give him 70 years or something when all I had to do was shut up, and everybody would have forgotten about it instead of making a big deal about it. But there are certainly non-terrestrial officers, and we certainly deal with at least five different sets of aliens, five different races of aliens. We have all kinds of neat technology, and we do all kinds of interesting things.
Okay, that's just a setup for the question. I don't know, it seems kind of obvious. Why create an Arab plot, even though I know there's the oil connection and the Afghan drugs connection, to really scare people? Why not just come out and say, we got hostile aliens, and now we really have to take control of your whole life?
Well, that's a theory that I once thought might happen. Werner von Braun's secretary was one who said that there was four scenarios that were going to happen, and that the one was the Vietnam War, and then the number one was the terrorists, and then there was going to be something else, and then there was going to be an alien threat. But I don't think it's going to happen. They probably have the technology, but my information is it's not going to happen. This 2012 nonsense, the planet Nibiru and the planet X and the end of the Mayan calendar, it's just stuff that is promoted by black operations within the government to keep people uneasy, to keep them worried, to keep them, worried about this and worried about that. And it's all nonsense. It's not going to happen. 2012, that year will be just like 2013, which will be just like 2009. There will be wars like there are going now, and there will be earthquakes and stuff, but there's not going to be any planet collision or end of the world or anything like that.
Good. Thanks for reassurance.
It really is interesting that when you look on your website, which is the website that is has a lot of your information on it, the Living Moon, the many avenues that you have of interest, and one of them you have there's a section that gets into Steve Fawcett. it talks like you didn't know him, but you're familiar with the site where he disappeared. Is that correct?
What was the question?
On the website, The Living Moon, it does get in a little bit into Steve Fawcett's death. And you didn't know Steve Fawcett, but you're familiar with the area that he supposedly crashed and that sort?
Yeah, he crashed over by Mammoth. I guess he just decided it was time to commit suicide.
And you think he did that?
Pardon?
You really think he did commit suicide then, huh?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And where did he crash?
Over by Mammoth Lakes, Mammoth Mountain, somewhere in that area. He just flew right into a mountain.
Wow. I mean, to do the kind of flying he is, that's kind of sad.
He had a lot of financial problems. He had a lot of problems with, he had several mistresses, and things were piling up on him, and I guess he just decided it was time to go.
Well, that kind of explains that a little bit. And the last time we had you on the program, we got in a little bit into some of this, the naval area out there in Nevada. Do you want to explain a little bit more about that? I've been finding a lot more information about these deep underground military bases and the equipment that they can drill these large tunnels in the ground. Would you like to explain a little bit more on that one?
Yeah, there's about 200,000 miles of tunnels under the ground that are traveled regularly by people who are employed by the government to transport material or whatever. The Navy has their own underground high-speed transport system. It's called the Tubes, and the base of it is in San Diego, and they can send their personnel anywhere in the United States, possibly anywhere in the world, in less than an hour. I don't know how that system works, but I do know that that system exists. Now, one of the interesting thing is I moved to Las Vegas in 1973, and my folks lived up in Reno, and I spent many, many, many years driving back and forth from Las Vegas to Reno, and halfway between, in the middle of the desert, is a place called Hawthorne, Nevada. It's a little town. It can't have more than a couple thousand people, but right at the entrance to the town on the right side of the road, there's a blue sign, and it says Naval Undersea Training Center. And you wonder, now, what would a Naval Undersea Training Center be doing out in the middle of the Nevada desert? And there's a few buildings there, some of them quite large. And there's also a lake there called Walker Lake that can't be more than 100 feet deep. It's about 15 miles long. And then on the other side of the road, there's the U.S. Army Ammunition Depot. And thousands and thousands and thousands of bunkers full of ammunition and all kinds of munitions there. But what interested me is, what in the world is the Undersea Warfare Training Center doing there? I mean, what do they do in a building there in the middle of the Nevada desert that they couldn't do better in the ocean? So then also as a pilot, I flew over this place many, many times, and on I think three different occasions, somebody in the cockpit would say, that's actually a submarine base. And that was kind of hard to believe because, first of all, you could even fit a submarine into Walker Lake. And I was wondering how it could be a submarine base. And then a couple of years ago, I ran into a guy who told me exactly what it was. And he says what it is there is a submarine base, but it's 4,300 feet below in the Pacific Ocean. He said the Pacific Ocean actually underlies the part of the western United States, including California, Nevada, Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. And what they do is they can get into this undersea ocean through an opening that's near Monterey Bay, just north of Monterey Bay. There's a giant opening that they can go under there. And there's a channel between there and Hawthorne, Nevada, which is about 212 miles long. And there's a huge submarine base 4,300 feet under Hawthorne. And this is where those submarines receive their munitions, because these munitions are built at the Army Depot and then taken across the road to the Naval Undersea Warfare Center. There's a huge elevator there that goes down the 4,300 feet and takes them to the submarines. And since I started coming out with that story, I've had at least three people confirm, yes, that's true, that's what they do. And there are submarine bases in different places. For one, China Lake, there's a submarine base there. Memphis, Tennessee, there's a submarine base there. And in St. Louis, Missouri, there's a submarine base there. And there's probably lots more that I don't know about.
So in other words, they may have a water system that they can transport water all around underneath the ground then, is what it sounds like you're saying here.
Yeah, the Pacific Ocean goes under these areas, and they just use the Pacific Ocean to get to these different places.
Right, but then you could also possibly do it with fresh water, too. And the only reason I'm going that direction is because, I mean, there's some other things that are going on with our water that just makes me want to explore that a little bit more. And now that I hear more people talking about this tunnel system, it sounds more feasible. And when you have so much value being put on the water itself. Katie, have any questions?
Boy, I have so many at this point. In some of the writings that I looked at, did you say that mankind is an alien-controlled experiment?
Yes, and I was wrong. Mankind is just one of, the Earth is just one of billions and billions of Earths where people develop, where souls develop. We're here to develop our soul, and the basic thing that we're supposed to do is live our lives with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed. And once we get that down, we get to go off and play with the adults in the universe. But until we do, we keep reincarnating here on Earth and living over and over and over until we learn this lesson of learning to live with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed.
Where do you get this information to come to this conclusion?
This information comes from, originally a guy started posting on ATS, a website. His name was Sleeper. And he started posting some stuff, and I kind of started reading through it, and I said, this is true. And he was a Army, he was born in Italy, American-born in Italy, and joined the U.S. Army, and all throughout his life, he was taken by aliens throughout the universe and showed all kinds of different things. And for whatever reason, he was told to impart this knowledge starting about 7 or 8 years ago.
So he's kind of like Billy Meyer then?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay. So I was listening to an interview, the fellow was new to me. His name was Joseph Montaldo. Does that name sound familiar at all?
No.
Well, he was having a discussion with someone that saying that there's a lot of abductions, and it's really not a subject that I've gotten into heavily on this program. But I'm running across this information a lot, and. And this apparently, you seem to feel that that's got truth to it, correct?
Well, there's obviously more to our lifetime than what we know about, and there's all kinds of people that claim to have the truth, and Billy Myers is one, Sleeper is another, and Ashtar is another, and I picked Sleeper because his story seems so believable and so true.
And the hardest part for me is how do we base that on? Does he have any way of proving it to us, or is it just?
Or Melody, maybe How did he? What did he disprove that you originally thought about us being created by aliens?
Now, say this again.
What did he disprove to you from your original assumptions or information about the human race having been created?
Are you asking me why I believe Sleeper?
In a way, yes.
I have been in this UFO research since 1985, and I have read everything there is to read, seen everything is to seen every video, listened to every story. And when I started reading Sleeper's posts on ATS, it was so interesting, so real. It just hit me as, you know what, this guy is telling the truth. This is the real story. And that's how it hit me. Now, how it hits anybody else, you know, I can't, I can't tell them, you know, whatever, but I believe it.
Well, John, I just want to say I have a whole lot of respect for your integrity. It's very peculiar, I think, in this realm of discussion on the internet and on radio and everywhere for someone to say, I was wrong. And so I think that's a sign of integrity right there. But I'd like to know, you must think about intelligence agencies and their attempts to manage you, to dress up in impressive titles and suits and try to influence your research in some way. How do you defend yourself against that?
They have influenced me. For one thing is through very slick maneuvering, they told me through a contact that we had been on the moon since 1962, we'd been on Mars since 1966, and since then I found out that's all baloney. We never went to the moon, we haven't gone to the moon, we can't go to the moon simply because of the Van Allen belt. All our stuff is in low Earth orbit, and that's all we're going to go for quite some time. And I say, you know, I'll admit when I'm wrong and the things that I've said that are wrong. One of the big thing was that the aliens are eating us. I was wrong about that. Now, there may be some really bad aliens that do that, but mostly they don't. And now, whenever I make a post or something like that, I always say this opinion is good until midnight tonight.
So if we're in a low Earth orbit and part of the shuttle is actually taking food somewhere, they're never leaving a low Earth orbit?
No, they never go more than about 300 or 400 miles, because the Van Allen belt starts at 450 miles and goes to 25,000 miles. And the reason is this is kind of a prison planet, and they don't want us going anywhere. They don't want us spreading the kind of democracy that we spread anywhere in the universe. We're here, you know, to develop our souls, and that's it.
Then why do we have so many astronauts? Don't
many
we
do
have
think?
Like 40,000 astronauts?
No, 5,000.
5,000.
Yeah, 5,000. When you join the Space Command, the very first thing they tell you is say goodbye to all your friends, because you're going to have a whole new set of friends, and we don't want you talking to your old buddies, specifically because we don't want you to run into an old buddy at the bar and say, you'll never believe what I'm doing, you know. So that's how they keep a lot of this secret. But it takes a lot of astronauts to man all the stuff that we got going. And the 8 to 12 orbiting weapon satellites that we have are just a minor portion of all the stuff, all the secret stuff that we have going on. I'm always amazed at how they keep promoting the SR-71 and what a great airplane it was and the F-117A and how great it was and everything. We have stuff that's much faster than that, you know, and much more capable of that, and a lot of stuff that goes single stage to orbit, but they found out how to keep a secret, and I don't know how that is, but however they keep a secret, the public is not allowed to know about any of that.
With all the things we have currently in a low Earth orbit, because we have so many satellites up there, are you surprised that we don't have more run-ins? Like, a few months ago, there were two satellites that impacted one another.
Yeah, no,
one of them was ours.
That's typical NASA disinformation. They would like you to think that there's so much stuff out there that collision, but people don't know the vastness of space and how big it is, and NORAD tracks every single object that goes up and is that accidentally released from any vehicle. They know where everything is, so there's no problem at all of any of that. And that collision was probably intentional,
just
to promote this story.
Wasn't that the U.S. and Russia, or France and Russia?
Yeah, of course, the U.S. and Russia have always been partners ever since the end of World War II. The Cold War was pure malarkey, and it was strictly for the public. We've always been allies. We supposedly went to the moon, and Russia supposedly went to Venus. We were just dividing up stuff like that, but we've always been allied in all our efforts. As a matter of fact, Russia is the controlling agency for the International Space Station, not the U.S.
I just was listening to an interview you did with George Norrie and Richard Hoagland, and you guys were getting into some of the structures on the moon. Now, are you saying that probably you don't really subscribe to that anymore? Is that what I'm understanding now? Or
subscribe to what?
You're saying that we didn't go to the moon ever then?
Absolutely not.
So
it was all a hoax. And the reason I believe that is because about a year ago, a friend of mine sent me the NASA landing videos of Apollo 14, 16, and 17. He said, take a look at these and tell me what you think. And I had never looked at them before because I'm what you call an Apollo hugger. I believed that the astronauts were my heroes. I met a couple of them. And I've always believed we went to the moon. And I looked at these landing videos, and they were so fake. And the dialogue was just like a script. And I realized that had been fake, so I started backtracking to find out, well, what do I know for sure about going to the moon? So I got all the Apollo books and started reading Bill Kaysing, who I thought was a nut, and he wrote We Never Went to the Moon. Started reading his stuff, and I realized, you know what? We didn't go. And that's why Neil Armstrong has been in seclusion. That's why the Apollo astronauts have never, ever had a reunion. And a lot of things account for that. But no, absolutely not. There's no way we ever went to the moon.
Then what about the structures that you were discussing on this?
The what?
The structures in these photos that you have talked about in the past.
Those all belong to somebody else. You know, the moon, there's probably millions of people that live up there. And the problem people have with that is they've been so ingrained over the years that the moon has no atmosphere and that it has 1/6 gravity, that they believe it. But they don't keep up with physics. If you just take the time to read the 1993 book written by Terry Spolter, S-P-O-L-T-E-R, and the book is called Gravitational Force of the Sun, she proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that Newton was wrong and Einstein was wrong. And she does it with mathematics, and she does it clearly and scientifically. But basically what she says is that mass is not attracted to mass. Gravitation itself is not proportional to the mass or density of an inert planet. And so what that means is, and she proves all that, and so what that means is all the stuff we've fed about the moon is false, because the 1/6 gravity is derived from the fact that we're told that the density of the moon is 3.34 grams per centimeter squared, and that the Earth density is 5.5 grams per centimeter cubed, and because of the distance and the size, that the moon is 1/6 gravity. That's baloney. If you take the Bully-Aldous-Newton law of inverse square and use that, which you don't need density for, all you need is the size of the object, the distance, and the neutral point, you'll find out that the gravity on the moon is is between 65% and 68%. Now, that's using the neutral point of what Wernher von Braun told us it was, which is 43,395 miles. He may not have had the truth. It may be more. It may be 1G. But whatever it is, there's an atmosphere on the moon, and there is people that live there, breathable atmosphere, people that live there, and gravity almost similar to Earth. And the sky is saffron yellow. Daytime sky is saffron yellow.
So are you also saying that we are visited by other life forms, but because of that Van Allen belt, we can't get through it, but they can?
We can't get through it, but they can.
Okay.
And how are we different that they can and we can't?
Well, the technology is you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of years ahead of what we even, you know, can conceive of.
So they've adapted it for their particular form, and it hasn't been adapted for us yet.
No, they adapted it around Earth so that we can't get out, so we can get in,
okay.
So we can do what we're supposed to do, which is to develop our souls.
And so, ultimately, I believe I was listening to a speech by George Bush about us going to Mars and that sort. That was just kind of a pie in the sky thing. Are they really trying to, you know, continue to work in that direction?
Yeah, that's all nonsense about going to Mars and going to the moon and everything. And you'll notice that, you know, a few years ago, President Bush said, we're going to reactivate the program and go to the moon. And then all of a sudden, you know, they found out they couldn't find any of the original drawings or parts or anything to do with Apollo because there was nothing, you know, in the beginning.
Because there was nothing to do with Apollo.
Yeah, they said that the contractors had thrown away all their drawings. Well, there were never any drawings. And, you know, Gus Grissom, bless his heart, in 1967, you know, he made the misstatement about Apollo, and he was, you know, on Apollo 1. And he made the statement when he looked at the Apollo spacecraft as it was delivered from North America, and he said, this thing ain't going to the moon in 2 years. This thing ain't going to the moon in 10 years. And he was right. It wasn't going. It was just a fake. And that's why they had to kill him. NASA killed both Grissom, Chaffee, and White. And they did it in that supposed fire there at the top of the, I think it was Pad 34 or whatever it was, that terrible, terrible accidental fire they had. But they had to get rid of Grissom because he was just mouthing off and he was spoiling the program.
So all the when you got into the discussion with Richard Hoagland about the moon being artificial, is there, do you still subscribe to that?
Yeah, the moon is probably a spaceship. It was probably brought here in the end of the last ice age, which I think was about 11 to 13,000 years ago. You know, I don't know for sure. I speculate mm-hmm. it was. But there's a time in a man's history when we can remember when there was no moon, and then there was two moons, and now there's one moon. So that thing hasn't been there forever. It's been there for a very short time. And the people that live on there are people from doing a TDY, that's temporary duty assignment, from Venus, Mars, Jupiter, all kinds of different places. And also the Grays have their laboratories there underneath the surface of the moon.
So
now, you know, we're fed this baloney that Jupiter, Neptune, Saturn, and there's one other that are gas giants, and that's not true. There's only one gas giant in this solar system, and that's NASA, NASA. That's the only gas giant we have.
So what about our space probes?
Unmanned.
Okay, but
the unmanned
space probes
are
something
apparently able to make it through the Van Allen belt.
Phobos?
Lunar orbiter, well, first of all, the Russians with Luna 3 were photographing the far side of the moon in 1960. They actually landed a remote vehicle on the moon in 1966 and brought back a sample. And then we sent the Lunar Orbiter series, there was five of those, that sent back fantastic pictures between 1965 and 1967. And then we've had Clementine and a few others go up there and take pictures.
So that doesn't make any questions to you if we can get an unmanned, why we can't get a manned through that, Van Allen?
Because the radiation kills a human.
So it's radiation.
But what, are you saying the moon is complicit with the Van Allen belt, or that these races are complicit in keeping a Van Allen, or generating the Van Allen belt in order to encase us, and imprison us?
Yeah, the guys on the moon are our keepers.
And how are they so evolved in their souls beyond us so that they can make that judgment, and how are they trying to help us evolve?
Well, they give tours to selected people on Earth. For instance, Howard Menger got a ride in 1956. His book, From Outer Space, is extremely interesting because he tells the whole story about how he met these people and how he was taken to the moon and how he had to go through decompression for a week and how he went on the moon, where he stayed. They took him on a train trip across the moon that took 5 days. They showed him all kinds of interesting things. George Adamski has the same similar story. There's many people on Earth, probably millions, that have been taken there.
So is the Van Allen belt before the moon or after the moon?
Before.
I don't know.
Okay.
You mean was it put there before the moon arrived?
No, I meant like, you know, it, you know.
It's between us and the moon. It keeps us from going to the moon.
Okay.
No,
Why do you think so many people think that they are abducted?
Everyone gets abducted. Not 1 in 10, not 1 in 20, not 1 in 30, everyone.
And what do they do? Well, is it the Greys that take them?
The Greys, yeah. They're in charge of what is called a container, and the container contains your soul. And as your soul matures on Earth, it occupies a container, which is our body. And when we die, we get a review of all the things we did in our life, all the little nasty things. We're not judged. We're just shown what we did. And then we're sent back into a newborn baby, and we try it again. And the object is to learn to live with integrity and without envy, hate, and greed. And once we learn that, it may take 10 lifetimes, it may take 100, it may take more than that. But once we learn that, then we go out. We get to go out and play with the adults and the rest of the universe.
Do we become a different species?
No, we become essentially humans, but much more evolved.
So we're to learn to live with integrity.
And without envy, hate, or greed.
And without envy, hate, or greed. Thank you.
Well, you know, I just looking at the amount of books out there that has the kind of information that I'm sure that you've had to study over the years, just with the things that I skim through on my own, I find myself getting real confused at times. You know, I think I understand something, and then something else comes along that really makes a lot of logical sense. Have you run across that sort of feeling when you study this, you know, this aspect?
Yeah, I was confused myself here. What do we do? Where do we go? How do we feed all those starving children in Africa? How do we rectify the people that were killed in Iraq? What do we do about the dope problem? What do we do about, you know, our social problems in the United States? And it all comes back to one thing. You are only responsible for you. It all starts with you, and you have to learn with integrity and without envy, hate, and greed. And you have to take care of your family, love your family. And this doesn't mean a love you as you're flying out the door to work. This means taking your family in your arms and telling them how much you love them. You don't have anything else to do on this earth. You don't have to worry about all that other stuff that's going on. All you have to do is worry about yourself and your family.
And do you think a lot of the other people that have been so involved into the space and UFO aspect and that, and aliens study of these various subjects. Do you think they're coming out with a lot of the same type of conclusions, or is it? Do you think it's splintered quite a bit?
It's pretty well splintered. You know, they have this disclosure program, and they think they're going to force the government to come clean on UFOs. The government's not going to come clean on UFOs. They don't know anything about it. They, you know, they have allies, or they deal with four or five different sets of aliens, but they really don't know what's going on. So what are they going to tell anybody? So there is going to be no disclosure. There will be no disclosure maybe for four or five generations.
Well, thanks for your disclosure. Can you catch that point again where you said everyone is abducted? Me, you, Melody, we're all...
Everybody. Everybody's abducted by the Greys, usually the first time about 3 years old, the second time about 7 years old, the third time about 13 years old, and then whenever they need to do an inspection, check the oil, check the fan belt, check the spark plugs, that kind of thing.
And are they checking the soul or the body?
No, just the body. The Greys are not in charge of the soul. They don't have anything to do with the soul. Now, they have the capability of moving the soul if they're told to, but that's not their responsibility. That's somebody else.
What happens to the other 5.5 billion souls if the plan, or 5.95 billion souls, if the plan to reduce human population to 500 million, as is alleged in a lot of the people who we've had on the show and you see on the internet, is true, if that's what the UN slash, you know...
Georgia Guidestones?
Yeah, if that whole thing happens, what's your take on what would happen?
Never, ever, ever happen. There will be no reduction in population. All that stuff you hear is just pure baloney.
And why do you think so?
Because the aliens will keep it from happening. They're here to develop souls and to grow them, and for people to take advantage of that. They're not going to allow anything like that to happen.
So if they're here to develop souls, They're actually keeping the human race at a certain level because why?
Because why?
Because why? Why would they do that?
Why would they keep a level of souls?
Yeah, and why would they keep the planet right now, which we know is overpopulated?
Well, it's not overpopulated. What it is, it's undermanaged. We have as much oil as we can possibly use. The world's largest oil reserves are under the United States.
But do we have enough water? I think oil's real secondary.
We have plenty of water, and we'll always have plenty
drinkable
of...
Drinkable water?
We have plenty of potable water. We have plenty of everything, and we'll always have plenty of everything. All these doom and gloom stories you can throw out in the trash because they're just not true.
Yeah.
Well, what would the purpose be to develop souls?
To develop what?
Souls. S-O-U-L-S.
What would be the purpose to develop them is what she's asking.
There's billions and billions and billions of them in the universe. The universe is so much larger than you can possibly imagine. We're told that that it's probably 17 billion years to the edge of the universe. That's baloney. The universe is eternal. It goes on forever. There's billions and billions and billions of Earths just like ours. Some of them are more developed than us. Some are less developed.
So as we change, do we actually get to go to other worlds?
We get to go anywhere we want when we learn to live with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed. Now, some people think you go to heaven when you die. Well, if you haven't completed the integrity and without any hating greed, you have to come back here. But when you have completed it, you get to go to a place, and I hesitate to say by heaven, but just imagine heaven. Now multiply that exponentially by 1,000. and that's where you get to go.
That is an awesome thought, Mr. John. Wow. So where could our listening audience go on the Internet to take a look at your materials?
Just Google Sleeper and start from there. There's a, I think the thread was closed on ATS, but I still think you can read it. It's very interesting. He has a couple of books out, and you can find those. One is called A Day with an Extraterrestrial. That's extremely interesting. And there's another one called In League with a UFO, and that one is a technical book about what they did with the stuff out of the Roswell crash. And extremely interesting. I mean, I read that about every couple of months or so because there's so many interesting things that were in that vehicle that he talks about.
Do you know what year that was written?
No, I don't. Probably had to be within the last 10 years.
Okay.
But Google either one and you'll find it on the web.
So do you still have something to do with landoflegends.us or anything? Do you still recommend that site?
No, I think that's another part of thelivingmoon.com.
Oh, okay. And
that's all run by a guy named Ron Schmidt.
Okay.
And I'm just a contributor on
that site.
On thelivingmoon.com, part of the site.
Okay, and I believe I did run across something with Sleeper connected, a link from that, the Living Moon, to get a hold of.
Yeah, we have some of his stuff, and also we have the communications between me and Perry Spalter, who wrote Gravitational Force of the Sun.
Uh-huh.
I wrote a couple of essays on it, and I've always been weak in math, but I've forced myself to get up to speed to understand exactly what she's saying. And for people who want to order the Gravitational of Sun and really catch up on what's really going on, go ahead and get the book and just forget about the math. Just try and understand the concepts of what she's telling you.
Okay. Well, John, I really do appreciate you coming on the program this evening. Do any of you guys, do you have any more closing comments or a closing question here before we close it down for the evening?
One of the millions. I guess.
Just the secret is live your life with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed.
Well, thank you so much, John. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show.
Okay, anytime.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And
okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You, Katie.